Hello, and welcome to Jumpcast, the podcast brought to you by us, the award-winning team at Jumpcut Online. As there is no films being released at the minute in the cinema, we're doing a series of special one-off shows where all of us will be getting together and discussing various different things. I think Sarah's got a new exciting series coming up that she's going to be hosting, as has Audrey. But we're going to do a one-off show today talking about biopics, or biopics, you like to say it. We'll get into that debate later on as well. It all sort of came off the back of Tom Hardy's the trailer, I should say, for Tom Hardy's film Capone coming in the last few days ago. And as that was the only piece of film content we'd seen for weeks, we thought we'd talk about it. So joining me today to talk about biopics as a genre is, firstly, it's Fiona. Hello, Fiona. How are you?
Hi, Nick. I'm good, thank you. Very early over here in California, but other than that, I'm good, thank you.
We appreciate it very much. And joining me and Fiona also is Reese. Reese, hello, how are you?
Hello, everyone. How are we doing?
Yeah, are you feeling good today?
Yeah, not bad, actually. Yeah, I'm excited for it. I mean, I've really enjoyed the film that I was told to watch, so looking forward to it.
We'll get the debate out of the way early. Biopics or biopics?
I've got to go biopic.
Did someone just take off then, by the way?
it sounded like a large plane, yeah. I'm in the biopic team, like a biography or a
biopsy. I don't think it rhymes with myopic is my issue. I think it's biopic.
I've always said biopic.
When I was younger, I thought it was biopic, and then I was like, oh, isn't it funny that I used to think that, and now you two are saying it, so now I'm doubting myself.
But my argument would be that you don't say biography, you say biography.
Yeah, that's what I would say.
Anyway. Two to one, me and Reese win, so we're saying biopic for today. And on the topic of biopics, so we thought we'd sit down and talk about this. And me and Reese got our heads together and looked through an official IMDb list of the best biopic films ever made and picked one that we had never seen before to review as a feature review. So today we will be reviewing James Mangold's Walk the Line.
Hello, I'm Johnny Cash.
Fiona, I believe you are in a different boat in that you have seen this at least once, twice, multiple times.
Yeah, I saw it when it came out, and I think I've maybe seen it once or twice since. I've got complicated feelings towards Joaquin Phoenix, but I do actually really like this film.
Yes, I was going to delve into that later on. your relationship with Phoenix, but we will get to that.
Yeah, but this is a really good film, and I was glad to revisit it last night.
Yes, you did it at short notice, so thank you very much for doing that.
You're welcome.
But I suppose we should start really going into it. Sort of your knowledge, your base level knowledge on Johnny Cash and his career and his life. Where I'll go to you first, Fiona. Where did you sit with Johnny Cash? How much of a sort of presence that he had and his music had in your life up to before you saw the film?
Not a massive amount. I think I would have known like a few of the really big Johnny Cash numbers. But what happened around the same time that the movie came out is that Johnny Cash released a Nine Inch Nails cover called Hurt, which is incredible. It's an incredible song and incredible video. And I believe, I might have this wrong, but I think he recorded it after June Carter passed on. And there was only a short gap between June dying and Johnny dying.
Yeah, it was about 4 months, I think.
Yeah. So I think it might have been that interim period, but I'm not completely sure. And so that was like a massive hit, surprisingly. And then I know June Carter was involved in the making of the film in terms of like approving Reese Witherspoon's casting and things. But then they both died, I think, while they were shooting, possibly. So he was very much in the news kind of at the time, which obviously timing wise with the film did mean it ended up being quite a big hit.
Yeah, it was kind of played as almost an obituary sort of.
Yeah.
Way if him and June died sort of months before. It's kind of a way of everybody coming together and celebrating him, I suppose. Reese, same question, sort of your interest levels in Johnny Cash.
Yeah, I'm similar to Fee in that I never really had much of a knowledge of his music apart from his big songs. Like, I knew Ring of Fire, I knew Walk the Line, and I weirdly knew like several kind of lyrics. So like in the film when he writes the thing about I shot a man in Reno and just to watch him die, I knew that lyric, but I didn't know what the song was from. So that I don't know how I got that knowledge. But no, I never kind of grew up in a household. My parents liked Johnny Cash. He was a complete mystery to me going into this film. I knew Joaquin Phoenix played him, and that was pretty much all I knew. So
yeah, I was in the same boat as you in that I knew his greatest hits and I'd heard them and listened to them a few times, but I could probably list on one hand the amount of Johnny Cash songs I could name by off the top of my head. So I think that sort of probably benefited me a little bit, because going into this, I had no idea sort of about his personal life. His relationship with, what was his wife called, Vivian? And then and then his second relationship with June, and then obviously how his career sort of fitted into all of that. But we got to learn it all by Walk the Line, which was very good. I suppose we should really start at the performances, because I don't want to say that the performances sort of carry the film, because there's a lot of good work going on sort of in all aspects of the film, really. But Phoenix and Witherspoon are both phenomenal in this. Mm. Like, really, really, really good. And you said earlier, Fee, about your sort of complicated feelings with Joaquin Phoenix. You don't necessarily have to explain why. You can if you want to. But sort of what is it about his turn here as Johnny Cash that you find different to sort of his other performances?
Well, surprisingly, I mean, I'm not a huge fan of biopic performances in general, because I think, excuse me, they rely far too much on kind of imitation, often things like prosthetics as well, and rather than kind of, acting talent that comes from a more natural, kind of raw place. But I think as biopic performances go, this is a good one, because I don't feel like Joaquin is kind of cynically and studiously studying Johnny Cash's like mannerisms. I mean, obviously they did a lot of rehearsal in terms of singing, so they had like 6 months of like singing rehearsals before the film. But as opposed to his recent Oscar-winning performance, I don't think it's the kind of thing where he was like, you know, I've got to do this with my voice or my body language. I think it comes from, to me anyway, it comes across as coming from a more sort of real, raw, natural place, this performance. So I really like it. And what works about it definitely is the chemistry between Reese and Joaquin. Like, this film would not work at all if it wasn't for you being invested in those two people, so June and Johnny, and you're, you know, willing for them, despite everything that, you know, Johnny goes through, and he's not, you know, he makes lots of mistakes. He's not an angel by any stretch, but you have to be invested in them and willing them to sort of make it work and for everything to be okay for them in the end. And I think that really works because of, you know, the chemistry between the two of them.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a harmonious chemistry, is it? It's kind of like a more sort of chaotic chemistry. Mm. But that's equally as impacting and effective as on us as an audience watching it and making us buy into their story and their characters. Reese, your thoughts on, we'll start with Phoenix, because we've discussed that with Fee. Phoenix's performance in this and on him generally, I suppose. Do you see this as a sort of a different performance from Phoenix compared to some of his other stuff?
It's funny you say that, actually, because I think when I was watching it, I realised I think Phoenix is, first off, an amazing actor. I think he is one of the best working today, whether Feed agrees or not. That's a different matter entirely. But I do think that Phoenix has a certain type that he likes to play. He likes to play the kind of the broken man. He likes to play someone who's got lots of demons in his closet. And I definitely saw that in Johnny Cash in the film yesterday. But then at the same time, I did believe him. Like, I felt like I believed him as a character really, really quickly. And I really understood that he was a very shy person, that performing wasn't natural for him. And especially in his first gig, when he goes on the road for the first time, I think that's when he first meets June. You can see how terrified he was. But then as soon as the song starts, he changes into his onstage persona. And I think Phoenix did that really, really well, because it's clear that even though his name is amazingly Johnny Cash, there is a difference between Johnny Cash the person and Johnny Cash the singer. And I think they sold that really, really well. And I also realised what Fee said about how they had months and months of music training. I like the fact that his renditions of Johnny Cash songs are different. They're not just kind of copies, and he's got his own Johnny Cash style, but it's clear that it's a different voice and it's a different type of singer compared to the originals. And I thought he sells that really, really well. I think if I had any kind of complaints toward the start, it's that I think his rise from being this guy who wants to be like, he's stuck in a dead end door to door salesman job, to being, I want to be a singer, that kind of comes out of nowhere for me, where it doesn't really develop that quickly. It just suddenly, okay, now he's got a record opportunity to record a song. And I was thinking that developed very, very quickly. But I understand why, because there was so much more story to tell after that point, because it was more about him and June rather than how he became Johnny Cash.
You need to get him on the road for the story to happen. Yeah,
exactly. But then I had lots of kind of weird flashbacks to his winning speech at the Oscars this year, when he spoke about his brother and how he dedicated it to his brother. Because then obviously at the start of the film, you have young Johnny Cash and that brother in the woodshop incident. And that was kind of a weird bit of, you know, personal element to his performance, as, you know, somebody lost his brother as well. I'm not sure whether he did at the time of the film. Did he lose his brother before or after? What? Yeah. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it was 10 years, well, more than 10 years before. Yeah.
There was a weird bit of kind of personal element to his performance there with his older brother, who was, I thought he seemed like a really, really nice guy, his older brother. He seemed really, had a good head on his shoulders.
It is a very, take on that point, it does feel really personal. Mm. More so, like Fee said earlier, that with a lot of biopics, it's almost like it becomes like you're playing a caricature, and you kind of, I don't know, it becomes kind of like a sort of bad sort of rendition of something or someone. But I felt this was much more, I don't know, it just felt much more sort of focused on the sort of human level of him, rather than the sort of bravado and the, because I'm sure with Johnny Cash, that as we saw, there was a lot of bravado, but it really sort of focuses on the more sort of intimate and moments with him and June together, but quite a lot when it's just him on his own. Whether it was in his new house that he bought and then Vivian left him, or some other times when you see him on his own when he's either struggling with his drug addiction or stuff like that. But I thought it was really, really well grounded, and a lot of that comes down to Phoenix's performance, because obviously you have to believe in him. Because I think we should probably touch on this point as well, that the film didn't make me like Johnny Cash, if that makes sense. I know we're made to buy into him as a character, and all of our history of watching films tells us that this is the protagonist, this is the person you need to buy into, and this is the person you need to sort of support on their journey through to the end. But like, he does some pretty awful things, like throughout, like he's pretty, he has his moments where he's great and he's funny and he's charismatic and he's in his own way, he's sort of loving and caring towards June. But there are also other times that he does, maybe it's learned behavior from his father. His father is a twat. Let's put it out there. but there were moments that I was a little bit uncomfortable watching it. The the one that sticks in my mind is the proposal scene on the stage.
Yeah,
on the
end. That was really uncomfortable.
Like, she'd obviously turned him down on the tour bus, well, as we saw at the scene before, and then to do that in front of thousands of people, so to force her hand into doing it, I was sat sort of like squirming in my sofa, like, oh, I don't really like it.
Was that the one where he was weirdly kind of grabbing her as well and not letting her like leave his side?
There are multiple times, like you just said, where he got her on stage when she didn't want to, when he made her perform the song of her that her and her ex-husband wrote together, and then when they went to a show or something and she was sat the row behind, and then you were like, oh, which, he was like, which marriage is this or something. Like, there were moments where he was quite nasty.
Definitely.
And so I don't know what I was supposed to feel towards Johnny Cash at the end. Obviously, you're sympathetic towards him because he obviously experienced similar behaviour at the hand of his dad. And he'd gone through a lot, and his drug addiction probably wasn't helping it matters. But at the same time, I was like, I don't know, you've been a bit of a douche. I don't know what you two thought.
Yeah, I agree with you on the proposal scene. It's so uncomfortable. And if I was June, I would have absolutely hated that and be so angry and would have walked off probably. But surprisingly, you know, that is real. That is based on fact. He did propose on stage.
Yeah, so I did read that afterwards, yeah.
So I think it's important to show it. But also, it's not like it came out of the blue either, you know. Their relationship had been based on years and years of touring together. They were best friends, and you know, they did go on to have a 35-year marriage. So it's not like she was had a hand forced in terms of marrying him. You know, she definitely loved him. I fully believe that. But also the method of the proposal. But then she said, you know, don't propose to me on a bus, which kind of implies that she was looking for more of a grander statement. So you don't know whether that is, you know, she preferred the onstage proposal compared to being proposed to on a tour bus.
I think most people would. And I suppose it is fitting in a way because it was music that brought them together right at the very beginning. And so in that way, it's kind of sort of like, in inverted commas, romantic and fitting that would be where they sort of moved on to the sort of next stage of their life together. But I don't know.
I think I was more put off by him when it comes to the fact that when he first met June, like you could see in his eyes that it wasn't he was seeing his kind of like childhood crush as a celebrity. He was seeing someone that he wanted to sleep with. Like, he was like, oh my God, June's there. And I never felt that he was, he was ever faithful to his wife at any point. Like, I felt like he was always on the edge of cheating on her at all times, which that really didn't sit well with me at all, because I think she was given a bit of a short straw. And I realised they tried to kind of create some drama near the start when he was first trying to set his band up, and his wife didn't like it, and his wife was like, we can't afford, you know, to entertain your hobby. We can't afford rent, we need to pay bills and stuff like that. And I understand where she was coming from, but then he saw that as a chance to be like, well, if she doesn't support her music, then I'm going to do what I want to do on the road, you know?
And I mean, I'm always going to side with the 1950s housewife, like, in these issues. You know, he has three children with her. He kept going back, you know, and he certainly kept going back enough to father those children. I have a lot of sympathy for her because, you know, being a 1950s housewife, you are trapped. It's the definition of being trapped. She didn't have options. She didn't have the option to go on the road. She, you know, is an interesting contrast with June, because June has a child as well and she's on tour. Yeah. So you either have to, you know, decide what kind of mother or what kind of woman, what kind of person you're going to be. But she is given the short straw, and I think she's very much presented as the nagging housewife. But I have a lot of sympathy for her.
Yeah, I felt, and that sort of peaked when, I can't remember where it was, the new house, but I think it was in California somewhere. The new house they bought with his lake at the bottom of the garden and his wood and his tractor.
Oh, cool.
And he was just going around nailing up the photos of June, and she was like, "Don't put the photos of June on the wall." And he's like, "I'm putting the photos of June on the wall. I'll do what I want." Like, I just got that vibe from him a lot. Like, yeah. And because he's got, as I'm going to do what I want, and then when he doesn't get what he wants, like in those examples, when he goes backstage and smashes the green room up and like kicks all the sink everywhere, and then later on when he doesn't get what he wants by proposing to June on the bus, he then goes and kind of does it really sort of embarrassing, in an embarrasses her on stage and to make sure that he gets what he wants. I don't know. I think, I said again, I have no knowledge of Johnny Cash prior to this, so I'm basing all of my knowledge from this, but I don't know, it just seems a little problematic to me. But like you said, their whole relationship is built off this chemistry that's not sort of typical chemistry between a man and a woman. It's kind of like this chaotic energy that's just sort of like, they're just bouncing off each other all the time.
But also, I think it's good of the film, especially with the timing of it. You know, when they first started developing the film, he was an elderly man, then he passes away. But they didn't change anything about the script or about the film to make it more reverential. And I think it's good that the film doesn't shy away from those aspects of his character. You know, it's not presenting this, you know, perfect person. So it's good that it is showing all facets of him and how, you know, he's a complicated person.
Oh, absolutely. I think, again. We speak from just what we read and what we see on films and stuff, but people who are in this line of work in either music or in any kind of form of entertainment, they always tends to be some kind of sort of chaos or sort of that. It's not a straight road, is it? Let's put it that way. There's always some underlying issues somewhere.
But they always seem like the kind of people that they deserved each other in various ways.
Yeah. Yeah, they did. I've just sat here and slated him, but I think they, like you said, they're a good match. The chemistry that they have together is kind of like intoxicating, even though it's so chaotic. Like, I was watching it, I was so invested in them as a pair.
But what makes it so good is that Jean stands up to him. She doesn't take his bullshit, and she does stand up to him. And what I really like about the fact that it's Joaquin and Reese is that in real life, if you think about those two people, and you know, the choices they've made, their careers and everything, they are so, so different. You know, our image of Reese Witherspoon is, if you follow her on Instagram, she's like this perfect housewife. She's got a book club. She makes gingham dresses. And when you think about Joaquin Phoenix, he's very, very different to her. And, you know, with his real life partner, Rooney Mara, couldn't be further from our image of Reese Witherspoon. But I love the fact that, you know, they are complete opposites, but they made that film work. And what I really like about it is that he brought her back for Inherent Vice, like 10 years after Walk the Line. And I love her character in Inherent Vice. And their chemistry, again, she's not in it, like, she's not a massive role in it, but their chemistry, again, is so, so good in that movie, in the PTA movie.
It's not one I've seen, shockingly.
No, I've not. But,
no, I've heard it's good, but quite challenging to watch.
It is. Yeah. It's not to everyone's taste, but... I just think they're two such different people, but apparently they clashed a lot when they were doing the song rehearsals because they were both finding it really, really hard. But then once filming started, they became really, really codependent and really relied on each other so much and, you know, became incredibly close once they were actually filming. And I just think... they're such opposite people in real life that I think that's part of why the chemistry works and why they sort of spark off each other so much. You know, they really kind of clash, but in that, you know, hot way.
But I think that's what convinced me about them, was that I got the impression that when they were performing together, that must have been how it was to watch June and Johnny Cash, because whenever they were performing together, I was just hooked completely because... their singing voices are really, really good, and they were clearly just invested in the performances. Like it was as good as watching two great performances in a film as it was watching two great musicians on stage. You know, I got, definitely, I understood why they were so popular at the time. I understood why they were so famous and why they were so drawn to each other. And I thought that they sold that really well between the two of them.
I think it's a good segue to talk about Reese Witherspoon herself. We just talked about Phoenix, but she, again, she's just, whilst Phoenix is off doing his thing, she's kind of like the anchor, which I suppose we've talked, you talked about Fiona about her being a about the 1950s housewife, which is interesting because she kind of does play that role, but in a different setting. So it's like when they're on the road and there's that scene where she walked in and all the musicians are all drunk on stage, throwing bottles. Like, she still has to play that role, even though she's not stuck within the four walls of a sort of a house, for example. But I thought that, but Reese Witherspoon, Fiona, thoughts in this film particularly, obviously.
Yeah, I think she's amazing. I think she deserved her Oscar win for this, definitely. You know, I think if she's had a really interesting career, if you go back to things like Election, I mean, she's been around for so long. She was practically, you know, a child actor. But yeah, I think although it is a kind of classic Oscar baity role, and I do have a bit of an issue with the fact that biopic performances, you know, tend to win at the Oscars all the time. And going, I just think actors often go into a biopic thinking, oh, you know, this is my chance. But you know, she's really, really good in this film. And I just like her, how feisty she is, that she doesn't take any crap. You know, she stands up. And it wouldn't have been easy, you know, when she's in like the back of the car with like four men and she's the only woman. And you know, you can imagine that it would not have been easy for her. For the real June Carter to have been in that position, you know, touring with a load of blokes. And, you know, I just think she's, yeah, she gets that across really well. And she doesn't, you know, go along with things just to be easy or give in to people. She really stands up and, you know, doesn't take any crap.
No. She's just so engaging. I could watch, particularly here, but I could watch Reese Witherspoon in anything. Like, she's so, so engaging. Like, every scene, I know, like, she's opposite, like, Johnny Cash, allegedly, in this film. And Phoenix is such a power when he's on screen. Like, he demands your attention. But whenever I sort of saw them together, she kind of shone brighter. I don't know if that's the way, because she was lit or she was dressed. And obviously, Johnny Cash famously wore black literally all the time. And I don't know whether it's the way that it was staged, but sort of my attention was always sort of focused towards her, because like you said, Reese, like, Johnny Cash isn't sort of a naturally sort of a performer, really. So I thought he was kind of quite more subdued, where I thought she was just a bundle of sort of energy, both sort of good energy to watch and enjoy, but also, like we said, a chaotic energy that sort of bounces off.
I like the way she's introduced as a comedian as well. So, like, her very first introduction in the film is when she's a kind of, when she gets her dress caught on Johnny Cash. And then she starts kind of bantering off stage and she's like, oh, don't worry, I can keep this going and I can make it funny. You know, she is a natural performer. And they were all saying, you know, Johnny Cash was saying, I've been following you since, you know, for years. And she was obviously like a child performer. And I think that echoes Reese Witherspoon's real life as well, of being a performer from a really young age and just being really natural and comfortable as an entertainer on stage.
Yeah, no, it definitely comes across. Reese, do you want to speak about Mrs. Witherspoon a little bit?
Yeah, I, like you guys, I was really impressed with her. I do think that she definitely deserved her Oscar win. I really liked, like, how you said how she was a performer, when you could tell she was different to Johnny Cash in that she was as comfy off stage as she was on stage. And she just seemed like she was always meant to be on stage. But I also really liked it towards the end when Johnny Cash had his kind of outburst at dinner, and then he tried to start his tractor, and then his tractor went into the lake and stuff like that. Like, that was a scene that really sold me the fact that she could never really let him go. Like, despite the fact that she was always trying to say, we can't do this, you know, that you've got kids, like, she could never really give up on Johnny Cash. And she was always...
It was a line of dialogue from her mum in that scene as well. She said, what was it? You're already down there.
Yeah. I love that line.
Good line, that, yeah. And that was her character, where she knew very early on she was probably in love with Johnny Cash, but she knew he was this kind of forbidden fruit because of his own personal, you know, well, the commitments. Really, really convinced me that she was all like what you said earlier about him them being best friends. And I thought it was nice that it was never sold as a romantic relationship for a long time. It was always just these two people who they supported each other on the road when they were performing. Obviously, there was some tension underlying, but it was never kind of on the surface until very late on in the film. And I thought I really believed them as two friends first rather than two people who eventually would fall in love and get married and kids and stuff.
Yeah,
it does strike that fine balance because, like you said, Reese, at the beginning, when Johnny first sees her, it is kind of more lustful rather than sort of just like a human attraction. It's more like you said, that's a woman I'd like to sleep with. But like it does develop and really quickly as well. Like it could have got sort of bogged down in this sort of weird, sort of quite sort of creepy thing where he's just sort of following this woman around and lusting after her. But it sort of develops and evolves into a proper sort of friendship really, really quickly.
Yeah.
It's like there's a scene where that Fiona mentioned when they're all in the car together and straight away like it's Johnny that's sticking up for her and telling the others to back off her and sit down and shut up and stuff like that. So straight away there's kind of that sort of intimacy between them. Like, and once you're in a group like that, when you're all on the road together, I think we're two people sort of naturally sort of side together in that situation. I think that they painted that really well.
They did.
We'll move on to Mr. Mangold.
Oh, love it.
Was this his first? What? Where does this sit in his filmography?
It is an earlier one, yeah.
Let me just have a quick look on IMDb.
Oh no! But when I was watching it, like, because I didn't realize it was Mangold until literally his name popped up as being directed by James Mangold, and I realized, oh, 4 v Ferrari was really good. Ah, Logan was good. Like, he was just the guy that I kind of, without knowing, I was quite fond of. And
he's had a really weird filmography though. When you think about it,
yeah, I'm looking at it here now. Sort of Girl Interrupted is sort of his first big film, really. That was 1999.
That's a great film.
Is that with Angelina Jolie?
Yeah. Winona Ryder.
Then did Kate and Leopold, Identity, then Walk the Line, then 3:10 to Yuma with Bale and Bro.
You sail past Copland, which is an amazing film.
Sylvester, I've never heard of it.
Sylvester Stallone's best film, best performance. Copland is so good.
Take your word for it. Wow.
It's got a great cast in it.
It's really good. Yeah. Highly recommend.
I have a bit of an aversion to Sylvester Stallone for some reason. I don't know why. Yeah, and then obviously he did. Then he kicked into sort of the X-Men stuff with Logan and Wolverine, and then Le Mans 66 last year was great.
Nah.
And then he signed on obviously to do Indiana Jones, hasn't he? I think Spielberg canned that off, and he's going to do that.
But then if you look at films like, you know, Walk the Line is about Johnny Cash and it's about June Carter. But then if you look at things like Le Mans 66, Logan, 3:10 to Yuma as well to a point, they are about these men who are trying to find themselves and they're trying to achieve something within them, you know? So he's definitely got...
There's a very sort of similar aesthetic
in
terms of thematically and sort of, if you actually sat and actually compared that to something like Logan, Walk the Line with Logan, there's... You could draw so many similarities with them, but it definitely does seem to have an interesting, like you said, lost men.
Yeah.
but he does it so well. Like, he's got a great filmography, and say all the films of his that I've seen, I haven't seen obviously all of them, but they're really, really good, really, really good.
And it seems like obviously he's been active since the mid 90s, but you've got directors who've been after the same time.
I thought he was much younger than that.
In terms of what he's done, like, he seems to pick and choose his projects quite carefully.
Yeah.
Like, I feel like, because he had a 4-year gap from Wolverine to Logan. I know they're the same character, but, you know, I think other directors have directed much more in that time span compared to what he's, that's what, 25 years, and he's done less than 15 films, you know.
Yeah, but no, I say he's a very good director, and
yeah,
I don't think the direction here was anything astounding or sort of the sort of award worthy or anything like that, but it's just such a solid framing of a story between two sort of two people.
Yeah,
they are both kind of sort of lost souls, aren't they, really, in a way. But yeah, Mr. Mangold, keep doing what you're doing.
Big fan.
Do either of you have any other thoughts you want to add onto Walk the Line, things that we haven't mentioned that drew your attention?
I thought they could have done a bit more with his father and that whole angle, because I understand his father's point of view when, because he left the woodshop and that meant that his other son was unsupervised and that's what happened. However, like, he held that grudge for 30 years. And
yeah,
and it felt like one of those things that it wasn't as fleshed out as I think it wanted to be. So like later on, when they finally have that dinner and they've seen each other and he's seen his show and stuff, I never felt like that was as emotionally important as I think the film wanted it to be. I was much more invested in Johnny and June than I was in Johnny and his father.
I think that's the balance it sort of struggled to find, was because, like you said earlier, they needed to get through the first 20 minutes to get to Johnny and June on the road together. And I think that stuff with his father would have sort of been in that if they'd had sort of an extra 10, 15 minutes at the beginning to sort of expand on his world prior to fame and fortune. That would have benefited. Like you said, if there were, there even could have been a scene where a couple of times throughout his career, he went back to see his dad and his dad was still like, just like, oh, like, because like every son wants the sort of affirmation, like support of their father and support, like to know that their parents, well, every, yeah, they want to know that they're doing the right thing and their parents support them, especially their dad. And I think that, like, that's the vibe it was going for, that no matter what he did, what he tried to do, he could still couldn't get his dad's approval.
Yeah.
It didn't have the emotional impact. It sort of, like, yeah, it probably thought it had or wanted to have.
Because I thought it would when I found out that it was Robert Patrick playing his dad, I thought he would have a bigger role in the film than he did, because he is a recognisable guy. But he was barely in it for more than 5 minutes.
Fiona, anything you'd like to mention about Walk the Line?
No, not really. Just I hope people who discover it, you know, maybe as a result of listening to this podcast, let's, for example, so. I hope people do, you know, go on to listen to some Johnny Cash records. I really love Jackson. I've after rewatching it last night, I've added that to one of my playlists. And I just think, and that the record specifically, the Folsom Prison one. I think it's really worth listening to and discovering a bit more about Johnny Cash.
I think he is somebody that I'm going to delve into, because I say I could count on one hand the songs I could name off the top of my head, but he's a huge, like. If I think of my parents, for example, my mum particularly, her music is more classical based. So growing up in my house, it was classical music that she had on in the car or wherever. But even like if you spoke to somebody like my mum, she'd know who Johnny Cash was and she could name some kind of Johnny Cash songs. Mm. So like it's a bit of a blind spot in my music education. So I think it might be something that I look at, I reckon, off the back of this. Yeah. I'm intrigued. So go out and watch it if you haven't. Me and Reese rectified that mistake in the last week.
We
really enjoyed it. Quick scores out of 5 for Walk the Line. Reese?
I'm going to give it a 4 out of 5. I think performances are excellent and I really enjoyed the story of it all. I just think I've got a few hang-ups in terms of how quick the beginning was and the lack of father-related care from my point of view. Whether it's my fault, whether it's the film's, I'm not sure. I'm going to give it a very, very good 4 out of 5.
Fiona?
Yeah, I agree. 4 out of 5.
I agree as well. Full house, 4 out of 5. I suppose then, let's expand the conversation a little bit into our favourite biopic films generally. I've asked you both to think of 3 off the top of your head. I looked, I didn't slave over this too much, so there's probably some that I've missed for myself, but here are my three. Those first, you two. First one I thought of was First Man, because that's probably recency bias, but I love First Man. I think that was so undersold last year. It did, or whenever it was. What year was it?
2018.
What year is it? 2 years ago. 2 years ago. First Man's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan Gosling's brilliant. Claire Foy's brilliant. The music is brilliant. Damien Chazelle's brilliant. Like, the moon landing scene was honestly one of the best things I can ever remember seeing at the cinema, just in terms of the visuals and the emotional impact of that scene as well for me. Oh, that was a bit of a mess.
I think, I remember Jumpcut Online wrote an excellent 5-star review of the First Man.
Would that happen to be one of yours?
I don't know what you mean, mate.
So yeah, First Man is one of mine. Second one that I thought of was Capote. Which is, honestly, it's an amazing... Have you seen it, Reese?
I've not seen it, no.
I'll give you a brief sort of what it's about. It's obviously about the author Truman Capote, and it focuses on his the time of his life when he was writing a book called In Cold Blood, which, if you haven't read, is an amazing read. And it was... Capote sold it as a non-fiction novel, was how he described it when he released it. So it was a retelling of events around a sort of quadruple homicide in Kansas, where a family, what were they called? Cutler family, I think they were called, were all shotgunned down in their farmhouse by two men. I can't remember the first guy's name or the second guy's name, who is the more important of the two in terms of the film and the narrative, is Perry Smith. And it's about Truman Capote going, hearing about this story as an author, going and investigating it and going and meeting Smith, and I think one say his name is like Hickox or Hickok.
Yeah.
Like that. And then meeting Perry Smith and sort of he kind of became infatuated with him. I don't think it was like it wasn't like a sexual thing or anything like that. But it was like
that's debatable.
Well, yeah, it's implied, but it was never explicitly said whether that was what it was. But he became like really emotionally invested in Smith when he went to meet him lots of times on death row. And the book is really, really interesting. It's really, really worth reading if you can get a hold of it. It's because he describes it as a non-fiction novel, but his voice as a narrator, because of his affiliation with Smith, is really sort of biased, really, I suppose. That of the two, the other guy, I can't remember his name, is really painted as like a controlling villainous, like he's the bad guy, and Smith was just kind of like dragged along. Whether that was actually the reality of the situation, we don't know.
I'm getting Mindhunter vibes. Am I wrong?
It's kind of, he spends a lot of time going and visiting Perry Smith on death row, a lot of time. And it's all about, and the film just, it focuses purely on his struggles. We mentioned earlier, in this realm, he struggles with drug addiction as well. And his thing with that. But it's a really interesting film to see how that relationship with Smith sort of developed and how that influenced his writing of the book, which has been obviously praised for being a great book, then also criticized for describing it as a non-fiction novel. And there's loads of allegations that some scenes or some things that were said that Capote's made up for either narrative purposes or to sort of absolve Smith of as much blame as possible. But it's a really fascinating book and a really good film and an amazing performance by Philip Seymour Hoffman. God rest his soul. That was the only film I think he won the Oscar for that film. But I would highly recommend that to Reese and anyone who hasn't seen it.
Coincidentally,
yes.
Hoffman beat Joaquin Phoenix for the best actor in that same Oscar.
In that same year, was it? 2006 yeah. Oscars. Yep. Yeah. Well, small world. So I don't know if you have similar feelings on Capote. Fee, you've seen it, haven't you?
I have. I taught in Cold Blood at A level, so I absolutely love the novel. I'm obsessed with it. Capote is amazing, but I just want to give a quick shout out for Infamous, because it's one of those weird circumstances that happens quite frequently where two films about the same subject come out really close together. So Infamous, Infamous stars Toby Jones as Capote, Sandra Bullock as Harper Lee, and Daniel Craig as Perry Smith.
Oh, wow.
Craig as Perry Smith,
Yes. And it came out, I think, less than a year apart from Capote, and it's really, really good. It obviously just suffers from the fact that PSH won the Oscar for playing Capote, and it's the much more high-profile film.
Yeah, but, it kind of got sort of swept under the carpet.
But Infamous is really good as well.
I will check that out, because as I'm the same bit of you, I love In Cold Blood. I studied it as well.
And have you seen In Cold Blood, the film? That's really good as well.
I don't know that I have. Is that... no, I don't think I have. No, I think I've only seen Capote. But yes, so it's got my own fees back, and go and see it if you haven't seen it.
I will. I'm sure it's on Netflix.
I think it was. I don't know if it still is. It definitely was. And my third choice, before we move on to your choices, is a bit of a guilty pleasure of mine. I know people have a bit sort of different opinions on this film. Some people think it's a bit gratuitous, really, but like I like It's a Beautiful Mind. I really like A Beautiful Mind. I know some people don't like it. Which is the story of John Nash, the mathematician, obviously. And you haven't seen it either, have you, Reese?
No, I'm sorry.
I won't go too much into spoiler territory, because I think for the film to have its full impact, you kind of need to know what isn't happening and is happening at the same time. But it's about a mathematician, John Nash, who I don't know why he won a Nobel Prize for his... I tried to have a look in advance of this of what he actually did, and it's baffling to me. Like, mathematics. Like, I tried to read through what is his Nash theory, and it's just baffling. But I love this film because it is a biopic, but it also plays as like an espionage thriller as well for half the film. It's really cool. Ron Howard directed it, obviously. It's Russell Crowe and Jennifer Connelly as well. It's just a bit of a guilty pleasure of mine. I know it's probably not the best film ever made, and it's not to everybody's taste, but I think it's great. And Paul Bettany's in it as well. He's great in it. Yeah, it's really good. Mathematician goes to MIT, starts cracking codes, espionage thriller, but also with a bit of some other stuff on the side as well.
That sounds like my shit, I'll be honest.
That's as much as I'll say. Have you seen it? Have you seen it, Fee?
I have, yeah. I haven't seen it for years, to be fair. It's all right.
Say that again, sorry.
I haven't seen it for years, but I remember it being, it's okay.
Yeah.
Also, Nick, you say it's not everyone's favourite film, it won Best Picture.
I've heard, whenever I've said I like this, I've had a lot of people come back and say, meh.
Really? It is. Yeah. It's a bit icky, but like we can't really explain why unless you've seen it, Reese. So let's move on.
We'll go over to you, Fiona.
Yes.
What are your three biopics that you would have a little chat about and see that you put forward to recommend people to watch?
I'm going
to
make a quick prediction. I have seen none of these.
I will also put money on that bet, but I haven't seen that.
Okay. Well, as I'm always awkward, I don't ever play by the rules, and I'm not good with numbers, I'm not gonna stick to your three favourite thing at all. So I'm going to recommend some biopics directed by women, because obviously that's my little cause that I like to champion. So, Marie Antoinette, directed by Sofia Coppola. Bright Star, directed by Jane Campion. Wild Nights with Emily, which is an incredible film from 2018, directed by Madeleine Olneck. It's about the poet Emily Dickinson, but it is this incredible film that is based on more recent research to do with Emily Dickinson and the fact that she wasn't a shriveled up sexless shrew, recluse in her bedroom. But in fact, she was a very, very passionate lesbian, and she had a love affair that lasted for most of her life.
That is dispelling the myth, isn't it?
Yeah. Mary Queen of Scots, you know that I've talked about that a lot.
Great film. Love that film.
Is that the one from a couple of years ago?
Yeah, 2018. It's directed by Josie Rourke, who is a theatre director. It's got Saoirse Ronan and Margot Robbie.
I'm not going to class that as a biopic because they never met in real life. And just from watching the trailer, they met
they
in
do
the film.
Meet, yeah. Spoilers.
They meet very briefly, but I really, really love that film.
No, it's been on my watch list for ages.
It's just really
anything
well
with Saoirse Ronan, man. Saoirse Ronan is just an absolute diamond of an actress. I love her.
She is. To have the career she's had at her age is just phenomenal.
I know.
Absolutely phenomenal.
Also, I haven't finished.
That's all right, carry
on. Also, Can You Ever Forgive Me and Beautiful Day in the Neighbourhood. They're both directed by Marielle Heller. They're both incredible films. I really think that Heller should have been in the Best Director conversation. And the writing of those films is also incredible. And the last one I'm going to tease because it hasn't come out yet and God only knows when it will come out now. I saw it at Sundance of this year. I was lucky enough that I actually got to go to a film festival this year because since then every single other film festival has been cancelled.
Yeah, you're in a select group.
I am. But it's Shirley, directed by Josephine Decker. It's about the author Shirley Jackson, played by Elizabeth Moss. And please, please, please look out for that when it does eventually come out. Because
I've made a note.
It is my, it's in my top two films of the year so far. It is so, it's so good. It's incredible. And I know, I know I'm taking loads of time, sorry, but just a very quick shout to a few music biopics that I think have done it well because so many have done it badly. So
naming no names.
I'm happy to name them, it's fine. Control is a really good music biopic, and Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll with Andy Serkis is such a good film. And they are a million times better than something like Judy, which was I absolutely hated, was dire. And as regards Walk the Line, poor Tom Hiddleston tried to do a biopic that was quite similar to Walk the Line called I Saw the Light, and it's really bad. And it's really bad. And it's really interesting to pair those two films, Walk the Line and I Saw the Light, because if you watch them side by side, I think you'll realise what makes a good biopic and what makes a bad one.
Okay.
Thank you for those, Fee. I didn't make a note of them now, but when I listen back, I'll make a note of them. I'll look out for those, especially Shirley. That sounds good.
Yeah, I love it.
Elizabeth Moss is smashing it at the minute.
She's wicked.
Reese, over to you. I believe you have a bit of a Sorkin special for us.
I do. I'm one of the loudest Sorkin apologists anyone ever meet. I think he's one of the best writers around today, and when I was looking at lists of biopics that I've seen and on Google and things I haven't seen, I could not leave these three from my mind. So the first one I'm gonna shout out is Steve Jobs. I thought Steve Jobs was terrific a few years ago with Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs, and it's got Seth Rogen, and it's got Kate Winslet, and it's got Jeff Daniels, and it's a different film in terms of its structure, because it's made by Danny Boyle, and they structure the whole thing around three separate Apple launch events. So it does take a lot of creative liberties, and it puts lots of Steve Jobs' personal kind of family tragedies and traumas into these three separate scenarios. So it's kind of basically 45-minute, roughly, long dialogues between Fassbender and Wozniak and all sorts, and it's just amazing to watch. And there is a scene in the second act when Steve Jobs has an argument with, I forget his name, but it's played by Jeff Daniels, and that scene has the same intensity as the courtroom scene in A Few Good Men, which is also written by Sorkin, and it's just when dialogue is just firing so quickly and it's kind of edited so tightly that it becomes this really intense kind of battle scene rather than just the people, two people having a conversation. So I think Steve Jobs did not get enough love when it came out. I think it absolutely bombed.
Did Steve Jobs suffer from a similar, we've spoken before, wasn't there another film about Steve Jobs that came out at a similar time?
Wasn't there one with Joseph Gordon-Levitt?
I was going to say the Ashton Kutcher one. Is that not the same one?
Oh, sorry. No, I'm thinking of the Ed Snowden one, sorry.
Ah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, there was one with Ashton Kutcher, and I never saw it, but I heard that was quite shit. But I don't know what made people sleep on Steve Jobs, because it has such a great cast with it, and it's got a great, you know, talent behind it, both in front of and behind the camera, and for some reason nobody went to see it, and it's so underrated. I think it's brilliant, so I highly recommend that one.
Kate Winslet's really good in it.
Yeah, she's really good in it as well. She's kind of Steve Jobs' moral set compass, isn't she? She kind of grounds him as much as she possibly can. So that was my first one. You should watch that if you can. My second pick is a bit more popular. It was up for the Best Picture, and I think in retrospect, for me, it should have won Best Picture. It's The Social Network, which is about Mark Zuckerberg. And I think, again, the dialogue of that film is fantastic, but it also comes down to Eisenberg's performance, Garfield's performance, and Fincher's direction. David Fincher. And that film is still relevant today, and it's one of those films that I could watch on repeat and I enjoy it as much as I did the first time, because Jesse Eisenberg is so good at playing a dickhead that he's so convincing to me, and I find the whole film so entertaining and so engaging, and I just kind of find, for me, that is Fincher's best film in terms of filmmaking and how he constructs his films and how he shoots his films. And so I think everyone in the world has seen it at this point. But if you haven't seen it, go watch The Social Network.
I know somebody who hasn't seen it.
Who's not seen it?
Me.
Oh, you're joking. Oh, mate, it is so good. I think it's on Netflix. It's on. Oh, you've got to watch it. It's brilliant.
Nicholas Steele, you are hilarious.
I do my best.
And then my final pick is, I think it's, people have definitely seen it. It's not as popular as Social Network, but my favorite one is Moneyball, which is a baseball film.
Oh, yeah.
And it's Brad Pitt plays a baseball team manager, and he's trying to basically create a team without any money at all. And it's a film that's heavily based on statistics, but it manages to make it entertaining and it makes it interesting. And I love sports films anyway. Like, I recently watched Cool Runnings, Fiona, as a little hint.
Yay!
And not for the first time, but I watched it again. I think it's brilliant. And I recently also watched the film The Rookie of the Year, which is another baseball film. And I just find sports films in general so fun, and I really like them. And Sorkin, it's a different Sorkin film than what he's done previously, because it's much less about the quick dialogue. It's just about how these two kind of clever people are the two smartest guys in the room, and no one believes them, and it's them trying to convince them to follow their plan. And I think Brad Pitt's great in it. Jonah Hill was up for Best Supporting Actor for Moneyball. He plays a stats analyst, but he's really good in it, and he's really charismatic as this kind of shy, awkward computer nerd. But yeah, Moneyball, I think, is fantastic, and that is one of my favourite films of all time, not just biopic, it's one of my favourite films ever. So if you haven't seen Moneyball...
I'm glad you said Moneyball and not Molly's Game, because that's really what I thought you were going to say.
No, I like Money. I like Molly's Game, but I have lots of issues with it. So yeah, I love Jessica Chastain as well. I think that's still worth a watch, but it's not as good as those three.
It's funny you say that about sport films and you loving them so much. So like, the amount of sport I watch, I watch so much sport, but sport films don't really do anything for me.
I don't know what it is.
I'm the opposite, because I don't watch sport at all, but I like sports films.
Yeah.
I've not seen Moneyball either, so.
Oh, Moneyball is fantastic. It's
also, I've not seen Steve Jobs either.
So you've seen none of my three? Oh my god.
No.
You're missing out on Aaron Sorkin. Aaron Sorkin's gonna change your life.
I've seen some Sorkin. I saw Molly's Game was not good.
Did you see A Few Good Men? I think you did.
I'm sure I have.
You can't handle the truth. No.
I say I must have done. I must have seen it all.
and yet you've seen none of them.
Yeah, here we are hosting a film podcast. Right. So we opened that question up to Twitter yesterday, and we got loads of responses of people putting in their favourite Barbie films. So if you did, thank you. Obviously, I won't read through them all, otherwise we'll be here for hours. But we'll go with, let's just have a look through here. Aidan Osborne got in contact and said that he likes Capote, Seymour at its finest. Can't ignore that. Mm-hmm. Walk the Line. Excellent.
Yep.
And also The Aviator, which he says is very underrated.
Oh, yeah. The Aviator is really good. Really good.
Isn't it very long? I've not seen it.
It is very long. Yeah. I haven't seen it, but I know it's very long. Yeah. I went to go and watch it, and I was like, no. I've not got enough time in my life for that at the minute. Chris Gelded, Walk the Line, and another film, which I'm sure you can guess what Chris has put.
Is it Rocket Man?
It's surprisingly, it's not Rocket Man. It is, of course, Chris's favourite film, Bohemian Rhapsody. Thank you, Chris. Less said, the better.
Yeah, I'm not
going to. At least Joaquin Phoenix and Reese Witherspoon did like all their singing. That was really impressive, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
And
yeah.
You won the Oscars for that.
Yeah, definitely. I really like it when people put the effort in.
Elena also from, or Eleanor, sorry, from Jump, also from Jump Cut, said Erin Brockovich, which is another great film.
I've not seen actually.
We've run out of time to discuss this, but I think there's a really interesting discussion to be had about what makes a biopic as opposed to some other films, because some films just focus either on an unknown person or they focus on a well-known person, but in a very specific event. So, for example, Jackie, I think you could argue, is not really a biopic because it only focuses on a very specific period of time. So it focuses on Jackie grieving the death of JFK, but it's not a biopic of her. So we don't see like her childhood. We don't see her life. Do you know what I mean? So you could argue
that my picks were not biopics.
Well, I don't know. This is the debate, you know, I'm interested in having, but like I say, we're kind of running out of time. But also, like, would you, because some of the replies I had on Twitter as well, like, would you class Catch Me If You Can as a biopic, for example? Somebody replied with that. Erin Brockovich, would you class that as a biopic? Or is it about, like, a specific, you know, it's about a specific thing, isn't it? It's not really about her life. Her life from like childhood to death kind of thing.
It's an interesting point actually, because like if it's obviously in book form, a biography is childhood, breakthrough, career, later life. And like you said, to be a biopic, does the film have to do that as well? That's a really interesting debate.
I think there's a difference between movies that are based on real life people and events and biopics. To me, a biopic is slightly different to something like Erin Brockovich, for example.
That is a very good debate. We probably should have left that.
Or Dark Waters, the recent Mark Ruffalo film, which is really good.
Yeah.
Is it good? Is it good?
It is. Yes.
Oh, it's so boring.
I'll go down the middle because I haven't seen it.
Dark Waters, is tragically one of the last ones I saw in the cinema this year.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what the last film I saw.
My last one was the Sad Dad Ben Affleck one.
Oh, The Way Back.
What's it called over here? The Way Back Again or something.
Finding
The Way Back, yeah. Tyler Nunn on Twitter, we'll do a few more of these Twitter ones, has listed off a few here. Said Social Network, Reese.
Great.
Wolf of Wall Street.
Yes.
Raging Bull.
Mm-hmm.
Black Klansman. Straight Out of Compton, American Sniper, and Steve Jobs again. Agreeing with Reese. A couple more. Olivia Woodard has said I, Tonya. So,
I was going to mention I, Tonya, to be honest. I love that film. I think it's so good.
It's not got a name, but at 11122X has put Ray, which is, I really like Ray. Ray's very long, but very good.
Yeah.
They have said Catch Me If You Can. Wolf of Wall Street, American Gangster, and Hidden Figures, just to name
Hidden
a
Figures
few.
Is really good.
There are loads of good biopics out there. When I was looking down that list, Reese, that I sent you to sort of decide what we were going to do as our main review, there were so many on there. I was like, there's some good films on.
Oh, yeah.
So that is that. Biopics discussed. We probably should have led with Fiona's debate on what makes a biopic. I'll save that for
a... I was just sorry. There's a story in that question. That, you could write thousands of words on that.
So, sorry to bring a spanner in the works right at the end there. I am chaotic.
We'll get the three of us back to discuss it at a later date. So all that leaves me to do is to say thank you for listening. It also leaves me to do with a bit of the plugging at the end. So we've now got our Twitter back. Well, Jumpcat Online has, I should say. So if you've been fallen out of sync, we're checking up there for latest reviews, news and stuff. Make sure you get back in sync with Jumpcat Online on Twitter. You can support us at Jumpcat Online via our Patreon channel and website. There's a link to it on our website. And if you subscribe at the highest tier, which is, I believe, the only God forgives tier. Only God subscribes, even. Sorry, because play on the words. They're all Ryan Gosling themed. You get a shout out on here. So, Zoe Baines, Daryl Griffith, Let There Be Light Productions, Chris Wilson, Orla Smith, and Peter Hodgkins. Thank you very much for your continued support. If you want to join that esteemed list, you can, as I said, find the details on our website. There's three tiers. You don't have to subscribe at the highest tier, but any donations are appreciated. And that's it. Thank you to you two as well, I guess. You should probably get thanks as well.
Reluctantly. Begrudgingly. Thank you.
No, it's been great. It's been great. We should do this again sometime. So yes. Thank you, Reese, very much.
Thank you very much, Nick. Great hosting, as always.
Well, I do try my best. It's a learning progress, a learning process. Fiona, thanks to you as well.
Thank you, Nick, for being a good host despite never having seen a film.
Well, I don't know how I've ended up in this position, having not seen any films and hosting a podcast.
I do feel like you've definitely progressed in the last 2 years or so. Like you've seen
rubbing off on him, getting him to watch things.
I've got 40 years worth of films to catch up on. It's a long time.
Oh yeah, because cinema only lasted 40 years.
Well, 100 years of film. Anything that's over 40 years old is banned in my house when I go watch it. So if it looks old, it's not getting watched now.
That's
my girlfriend's rule. That's that. Thank you for listening again. Next episode, Audrey will be hosting. I don't know who's joining her yet, but she'll be starting off her series where she's going to work through the decades of cinema, starting in the 1920s, I believe. She's going to have a look, go jump in the time machine 100 years ago and see what was going on back then in the film world. So look out for that. That'll be there next Monday, regardless of what's happening. These podcast episodes will be going out every Monday as normal. So that's that. Keep safe, look after yourselves, and keep enjoying your films. See you next time.
Bye.
Jumpcast.